Good evening and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer's conversation with Teresa Kong. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. Please note this event is being recorded, and I would now like to turn the conference over to David Snowball. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Emily. Hi, guys, and welcome to the Observer's Chat with Teresa Kong, the manager of the Matthews Asia Strategic Income Fund. This is one in a series of calls designed first to allow our readers to hear a reflection on a fund's genesis and strategy directly from its manager, and then second, to give you a chance to raise questions with Teresa. Our plan is to devote the first third of our hour together to an introduction to the fund, the roughly middle third to my conversation with Teresa, and the final third to your questions. I wanted to note that the Observer has no financial ties to the Matthews funds, but as a matter of full disclosure, I have a personal investment in three Asia-centric funds. Strategic Income is one, the venerable Matthews Asia Growth and Income Fund is the second, and the remarkable young Seafarer Overseas Growth and Income is the third. Teresa and I are joined on the call tonight by Jody Morris, who is a member of the, or one of the leaders of the customer service team with Matthews. And I thought I would turn it over to at this point to Jody for an introduction.
Hi, well, thank you all for joining us today. My name is Jody Morris. Yes, I lead our team that works with advisors across the country here at Matthews. So I think as all of you know, Asia is our sole focus as a firm in running equity and now fixed income strategies led by Teresa. So we run about $21 billion in assets. We have 13 fund strategies available, and through the Matthews Asia funds through investors here in the United States. So I am going to turn it over to Teresa because what I think we'd like to do today is talk specifically about the Matthews Asia Strategic Income Fund. I think there's a lot to cover in terms of, you know, why we launched the fund, where this fits in and where it might fit in for all of you in terms of an investor's portfolio. I think there's a lot to talk about in terms of where fixed income is today. You know, you hear a lot of our bonds a bubble. So we'll certainly hear from Teresa in her comments and then in the Q&A addressing both the longer term case, but also where we are in fixed income, specifically Asia fixed income today. So Teresa joined us about 2.5 years ago, most recently from Barclays, where she led their emerging market debt program. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Teresa.
Thank you so much, Jody. I'm really excited to be on the call to talk about things I really care about, which is strategic income and Asia bond. So what I'd like to do is cover three main things in my remarks. The first is, what is the case for allocating to Asia bond? Second, what is this Matthews Asia Strategic Income Strategy? And then finally, what is my personal philosophy in running the strategy? So first, what is the case for allocating to Asia? As many of you know, according to the IMF, Asia already accounts for a third of global GDP. Going forward, it's expected to account for half of global growth. So Asia, by any measure, is a really important part of the global economy. However, if you take a look at a typical portfolio, so let's take a typical client with approximately 70% allocation to U.S. fixed income, 20% allocation to global fixed income, and 10% allocation to emerging markets. That typical investor would end up with less than 7% exposure to Asia. To get to that number, what I did was I used the Barclays Global Ag as a proxy for global fixed income, and then I used the JP Morgan MB Global Diversified as a proxy for emerging market fixed income. And what you find is that in both of these international benchmarks, Asia is less than 20%, about 20% to as a percentage of the region. And then, of course, you know, the U.S. component has no Asia in it. And so that's why we get 7% exposure to Asia. We'll talk, you know, I'd love to address the question later on as to whether or not U.S. domestic markets, especially U.S. bond markets, is a bubble. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. So I'll just leave that as an appetizer. So given that the typical investor has less than 7% to Asia, you may ask, you know, why is that? Why is there such a small allocation? And that goes to the biases with debt benchmarks. As many of you know, it's actually quite an honor to make it into, let's say, the S&P 500, right? You have to be big enough, you have to have survived, you have to fulfill certain criteria. But in the debt world, you just need to have a lot of debt, which in and of itself is actually not necessarily a very honorable criteria. And so what happens is if you take a passive approach to fixed income, you end up often allocating most to the most indebted issuers instead of those who are the most creditworthy, which is probably what you want to be allocating to. So, for example, if you were to just take a passive approach to emerging markets, you may end up having most of your exposure to countries like Mexico, Brazil, and Russia, which would be in proportion to those countries' representation in that debt index. However, if you took an active approach, you may end up with a greater weight to countries like Singapore, Malaysia, and the Philippines, which actually has a better outlook in terms of creditworthiness, interest rate outlook, as well as potential for currency appreciation. And that leads me to talk about why Matthews Asia Strategic Income, and what exactly is this strategy? When I joined the firm about 2.5 years ago, we really took the time to talk to our clients and ask them, what are the issues that you have? What are the key things that you're facing? And over, I heard three key things, which is one, how do I get yield in this world of falling yields? How do I get low volatility, or at least lower volatility, when I've just been burned by the global financial crisis? And based on these worries, if you will, we devised the Matthews Asia Strategic Income Strategy. And what it does is it's meant to provide the lowest risk of all of the Matthews strategies. And just as a reminder, this is the only fixed income strategy. So by design, it will be the lowest risk. But what's perhaps more interesting is the fact that it actually generates, based on both backtests as well as empirical returns based on our performance last year, it actually produces the highest risk-adjusted returns in terms of, as measured by the Sharpe ratio. So thus far in the strategy, we've managed to produce a Sharpe ratio of 2. Now, we don't expect that to be sustainable. As many of you know, a Sharpe ratio of 2 is very, very high. But we do aim to maintain a Sharpe ratio of greater than 1 over the life of this strategy. Now, let's peel back the onion and talk a little bit more about how we're going to actually produce those types of results, such high risk-adjusted returns. And the way we do it is by investing across both currencies as well as across the capital structure. So what do I mean by that? First, across currencies. As many of you might know, fixed income, especially when you move into emerging markets world, is really divided into two separate asset classes. One is what's called external debt, so that's predominantly U.S. dollar-denominated debt of foreign issuers. And the second is what's called locally denominated debt. So that would be debt that's denominated in the local currencies, in this case of Asia. So this would mean debt that's denominated in the Philippine peso, in the Malaysian ringgit, in the Singaporean dollar. And the reason for investing across currencies are actually several-fold. First, you know, despite the fact that U.S. dollar-denominated debt will always have some sensitivity to U.S. interest rates, it provides actually really great characteristics when the markets sell off. Whenever the markets sell off, U.S. treasuries tend to rally, and U.S. dollar-denominated debt will have that anchoring effect, whereby it will actually outperform locally denominated currencies. However, we also want to have local currency denominated exposure because that's where we can really leverage on the three key dimensions of return, credit, currencies, and interest rates. And we can then be exposed to both currencies as well as the underlying interest rates of these countries. And so when we talk about duration in this portfolio, what's really interesting is, you know, very few clients ask me, what are your durations to the various interest rate regimes? They just ask for what the duration is. But within the context of a multi-currency portfolio, it's actually very important to think about the actual individual interest rate sensitivities within each of the markets that we're exposed to. And so we think a lot about where we want to be long duration, meaning where we want to be long interest rate exposure. So that would be where we think interest rates have the most room to fall. And then we also want to be relatively short duration in countries where we don't think there's as much room for interest rates to fall, but we actually think that there would be higher potential for currency appreciation. And so that's how we think about the interaction of currencies, interest rates, and credit. And perhaps I can really drive this home by providing a quick exercise. So 10 years ago, if you had the choice of investing in a 10-year Mexican government bond, which by then, 10 years ago was, by the way, yielding about 9%, or a 10-year Singapore government bond, which 10 years ago was yielding just about 4%, which one would you choose? Well, if you were just fixated on the carry or the yield, you might have picked the Mexican government bond. However, when you move into the world of international fixed income, your returns are actually generated by three key drivers: credit, currencies, and interest rates. And in the case of the Mexican government bond, the currency actually depreciated by 4% over that 10-year period, which means that the total return on that Mexican government bond denominated in peso would have just returned 4.8%. But in the case of the Singapore government bond, you would have actually gotten the 4% yield plus the 3% currency appreciation, which would have gotten you actually a total return of over 7%. So that just goes to show that it's really important to not only just look at the yield, and many investors, you know, are very much fixated on what is the yield of the portfolio, but oftentimes the return of the portfolio is generated by both credit spread compression, as we saw in this last year, as well as some currency appreciation. And so you may ask, well, what do you mean by across the capital structure? Let's talk a little bit about that. What that means is that we have the ability to invest in bonds that are the highest in the capital structure. So these would be the senior secured debt of an issuer, or it could also mean all the way in the bottom of the capital structure, which would be the equity. And given the fact that this is really meant to generate strategic income, we wouldn't invest in any equity that doesn't have a dividend component. But we want to keep that in our toolbox, because what we also want to do is to create a profile for the strategy that gives it that price stability that I talked about, that risk-adjusted returns that will give us really positive optionality on the upside, as well as positive optionality on the downside, which I had just talked about. The fact that we have U.S. interest rate exposure is not necessarily a bad thing. Some exposure to it gives us the protection on the downside. But on the upside, we want to have currently we have just under 10% of our portfolio to dividend-yielding equities, which gives us that nice optionality on the upside when there's quite a lot of risk-loving behavior in the markets. And so in a nutshell, that's what Matthew's strategic income is meant to do. It's really meant to provide the highest risk-adjusted returns by investing in a blend of currencies as well as a blend across the capital structure. Now, perhaps I can talk now more philosophically about how we do this and what I personally really believe in. Very simply, we actually take a bottom-up approach to investing. And what that means in fixed income world means that instead of trying to extrapolate and try to forecast what GDP, interest rates, or inflation might be, we try to back solve from security prices what's embedded in the market expectations. And that means that specifically within the three key components of risk and return, credit, currencies, and interest rates, what we do is we try to distill within the credit spread, the currency forward curve, as well as the interest rate curve, what we think is over or undervalued. And what it really comes down to at the end of the day is what I observe to be oftentimes a difference in our investment horizon versus that of our peers. Because Matthews is a privately held firm, we really have the luxury of investing over a long period of time. So my investment horizon within this specific strategy is about 3 years. So we're not beholden to the shorter quarterly earnings updates that many public companies would be beholden to. Secondly, you know, I want to talk a little bit about why, you know, Matthews is actually uniquely positioned to start a fixed income strategy, which, you know, for some may seem like an oxymoron, given that we're really known as an equity shop. Some of the great things about being in a shop that invests across the capital structure is the fact that we're able to sit across management teams in a meeting and actually get a real holistic story of what they really think. So many times you're a debt investor, and the company knows that you're a debt investor, so they'll stress their belief in the sanctity of a good balance sheet and the fact that they're not going to leverage up. But at the same time, they may be in a different meeting in the same day and talking to equity investors and telling them how they're going to actually leverage up the balance sheet to drive ROE. And when I'm sitting alongside my equity colleagues, we're not able to, the management team is not able to do that. And I think that's really powerful to actually get a really holistic story from management as to what they're really going to do, knowing that their constituents represents all the stakeholders within their capital structure. And then finally, you know, we spend a lot of time because of our expertise and because how specialized we are in the region, really understanding the differences in accounting, in the legality of the different structures, so that we can at times take on risks that others may perceive as too risky to take on. And so our specialization is really a key differentiator here amongst other world bond or emerging bond investors. And so with that, I'd like to just again remind everyone that, one, there's a real case for allocating to Asia because of the biases in the benchmarks. Most of us are under-allocated, whichever way you want to cut the pie. Second, Matthews' Asia Strategic Income Strategy is meant to provide high risk-adjusted returns by investing across currencies and across capital structure. And finally, we take quite an unusual approach in that we take really a bottom-up approach to investing in fixed income. And we are really uniquely positioned to do that. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to David.
Wow, great. Thank you, Teresa. That's very kind. It's an interesting talk. What I thought I would mention to our listeners is that we're going to try to divide the remaining time about equally. What I'd like to do is take 15 or 20 minutes to pass along some of the questions that have been raised on the discussion board or things I have been wondering about, and then let folks have, say, the last 20 minutes, the folks who are listening, for questions of their own. When we get closer to that time, Emily will remind people of how they can let her know that they'd like to ask questions, and we'll field just as many as we possibly can. So, Teresa, here's the tension that I think a lot of people would see kind of in a fund like this. They imagine fixed income as the conservative, safe, and predictable portion of their portfolio, which is fine. And then they imagine Asia as one of the wild and hairy parts of their portfolio, where, you know, markets move much more dramatically than they might in other parts of the world, or at least traditionally. And you're sort of offering a hybrid for them of, you know, asking them to consider what's traditionally seen as a high-risk part of the world for a low-risk part of their portfolio. And so I thought, if you could, maybe you could talk with us a little about how you kind of imagine potentially the risks in the fixed income world going forward against what, you know, many investors have come to expect over the years.
Great question, David. First, let's talk about risk. I think most of us, having gone to business school, have been taught that U.S. Treasuries is a risk-free asset class. And I think given the fact that we're now in the 31st year of a 30-year bull cycle, just means that we are sitting at a point of relatively asymmetrical risk. And what I just mean by that is that over the next 5 to 10 years, U.S. Treasuries are just going to be more likely to go up than go down. And within that framework, it's really important to think about how you could get exposure to fixed income because at the end of the day, fixed income is still going to give you relatively lower price vol than equities, but have less sensitivity to U.S. Treasuries. And so what we did was we actually calculated the beta, so that's the relative sensitivity of the various fixed income asset classes throughout history to the U.S. Treasury. And just as a proxy, we used the five-year U.S. Treasury because most of the indexes are, you know, not too long and not too short, so we thought that that would be a good proxy. And just to kind of give you an idea of the betas, U.S. high-grade beta since about 1994 was the date that we started, because that is the common denominator amongst most of the indexes. The beta is about 0.7. The U.S. ag, 0.7. Global ag, 0.77. Mortgages, 0.5. Now, when you move to emerging markets, that number goes down to 0.3, so 0.38. And interestingly enough, Asia, again, if you divide the two, the Asia fixed income into the two underlying asset classes, local currency, which we use ALBI, which is the HSBC Asia Local Bond Index, and as well as the JP Morgan Asia Credit Index, which is called the JACI, we find that their betas are actually 0.28. So as you can see, Asia fixed income is actually one of the safer places to be if you think that interest rates in the U.S. are more likely to rise over the next 5 years than they're likely to fall. Second, David, I think what you're hinting at is the fact that, you know, is Asia inherently more risky? And what I like to do is to talk about a little bit about the fundamentals of Asia as a region. If you just look at IMF statistics, developing Asia is actually expected to have the highest GDP growth and actually the lowest inflation amongst the emerging market world. It's also expected to have positive current account, which, by the way, is good for the FX. And the technicals, or if you will, the flow dynamics are actually continuing to improve. So if you look at sovereign wealth funds and FX reserves within the region, it's actually one of the highest growing of any in the world. And so if you take the fundamentals into account, Asia is actually not as risky as many people think it is. And if you look at the relative price stability of, empirically speaking, of the Asia Strategic Income Strategy, it's actually been very, very good. So, again, we've been able to produce a Sharpe ratio of 2, and we expect that over the life of the strategy, we should be able to maintain a Sharpe ratio of 1, which really matches that of domestic fixed income strategies.
Oh, cool. So let me back up to a couple things you said just to be sure that I understand. You were talking about domestic treasuries. You said that treasuries are more likely over the next 5 years to go up than to go down?
Correct.
Now, by up...
yields, I apologize. Yields will go up.
Okay, so the price of the treasuries will go down, and that's
what drives
the yield up. So when you say that the treasuries are going to go up, you're saying bad things will happen to them.
That's exactly right.
Because lots of folks listening, I suspect, think up good, down bad.
Yes, thank you for that clarification, David. Yes,
okay.
I absolutely meant to say that, you know, we do think that the risk is skewed towards a sell-off in U.S. Treasury prices and a rise in U.S. Treasury yields.
Cool. And two of the abbreviations you used, when you talked about the U.S. ag, you don't mean the farm sector as much as the aggregate bond index, yes?
The U.S. ag as proxied by the Barclays U.S. ag.
Right, but when we say the U.S. ag, we mean ag here is short for the word aggregate, yes?
Yes, yes, yes.
And FX is foreign exchange.
Yes.
So when we talk about the kind of FX reserve, or when you talked about the FX flows, at base, the Asian economies are gathering foreign exchange?
Actually, what that means is that their reserve in U.S. dollars is going up.
Okay, which is also...
So it's not necessarily U.S. dollars. It's most of the reserve currencies, and many of the reserves are being diversified away from the typical reserve currencies of U.S. dollar and euro to several of the Asian currencies, in fact.
Oh, okay.
So FX reserves from the perspective of central banks is really any of the what we traditionally call hard currency reserves.
Okay. And so you were talking about your benchmarks, and I wanted to check, because you've got two benchmarks, and for folks who check your website, you do performance against each of them. And those,
that's right.
Figures seem to represent a dramatically different performance of the two benchmarks. The HSBC Local Bond Index has substantially lagged both the fund and the second index. The one that you referred to as Jackie, the J.P. Morgan Asia Credit, seems to have stronger, since you've launched, a stronger performance than the other benchmark, and a little bit stronger than the fund. And I was wondering if you could talk to folks about what kind of accounts for that difference.
Absolutely. That's a great question. So let's step back and ask, you know, why do we pick two benchmarks? Well, first, when we're investing across a blend of currencies, we thought it would only be fair to pick one index representing each of the asset classes we're using. So currently, we have just under 50% in U.S. dollar space. So you can think of it as, let's call it 50% allocation to the Jackie and 50% allocation to the HSBC LB. And putting that in historical context, the two indexes over the last 10-year period have actually returned about the same, of about 8% over the course of the last 10 years. What specifically happened last year is really interesting. First of all, the stars were really aligned for Asia fixed income across the board. So again, looking at the three key drivers of risk and return, credit, currencies, and interest rates, all three were positive contributors to return. However, the biggest contributor to return was actually credit spread compression. And so the Jackie, which has a lot of corporates, so it's predominantly corporates from Asia, their credit spreads tighten in relatively a lot over the course of last year. In fact, on the order of magnitude of about 300 basis points. And that led to the outperformance of the Jackie over the LB. FX performance, so the relative appreciation of Asia currencies to the U.S. dollar, was actually relatively muted last year on the order of magnitude of just under 3%, so two and change. And so given that, the LB underperformed last year and the Jackie massively outperformed the LB.
Mm-hmm. But in the long term, those tend to be cyclical rather than a kind of structural feature, so you're guessing that it's a reasonable benchmark because, you know, some years one will lead, other years the other, and in the long term, they're going to look pretty similar?
In the long run, if history is any indication, they have performed similarly. I would say that the U.S. dollar benchmark, just because of the amount of credit upgrades that Asia has experienced and the fact that a lot of that credit compression came from high yield, we're probably not going to have that degree of return consistently. So, yes, you know, over the long run, we do think that these two are good indications of how we're going to perform, and there's no structural reason why one would necessarily always outperform the other.
Okay.
The other thing that I'll just highlight here is the fact that the local currency market is still relatively nascent, in that we're really hoping that corporate bonds will continue to represent a high, increasingly higher percentage of that local index. And when it does, we actually think that the LB, you know, will have more room for appreciation, because then you're going to get that nice credit spread compression component in it. However, at this point, there's lack of a secondary market, so it's the proverbial, you know, you can get in, but you may not be able to get out. So currently, we only have a limited amount of local currency corporate exposure within the local currency space. And then again, maybe just a quick reminder that most strategies give you exposure to one or the other and not both.
Uh-huh. Great. So, and the fact that you have the flexibility to do both and as well to move elsewhere in the capital structure gives you a chance to duck a bit.
That's right.
Things change. One of our readers, Charles, had been kind of curious about whether that's a factor at work in your geographic allocation in kind of looking through your holdings. He said that it occurred to him that you had no holdings in New Zealand, Pakistan, India, or Taiwan, and he was sort of wondering what had driven that decision.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. Thank you very much for doing such deep work into my strategy. The specific countries that you talked about, they had deficits in one of the three key drivers of return, whether it's credit, currencies, or interest rates. I'll just highlight maybe one of them, Pakistan. Pakistan does have a sovereign bond outstanding in the U.S. dollar-denominated space. We don't think that the credit spread that it commands represents the underlying risk of Pakistan. So we currently don't have any exposure to that country. In the case of Taiwan, you know, Taiwan is one of these countries where we've typically reserved our risk budget for the dividend-yielding equities. And the reason is because, again, looking at credit currencies interest rates, the interest rates in Taiwan has been historically relatively low. The currency also has not done particularly well. And if you look at the forward curve of the Taiwanese dollar, it almost always imputes a much higher appreciation than is actually experienced. And so that's where we actually like to reserve for good dividend-yielding equities. And at the current moment, we actually don't have any exposure to Taiwan, and that's absolutely right. New Zealand is not a core country for us, so it's called Asia, not Asia Pacific. And as per 40 Act mutual fund rules, anything in Australia and New Zealand would be considered to be peripheral. So currently, New Zealand is not one of the countries we're seeing really compelling opportunities. So I hope that gives our reader a better feel for how we do our geographic allocation.
Well, and I suspect Charles is actually in the audience, so if he's you know, kind of incensed by the answer, he'll have a chance to come in and defend the poor New Zealanders. When you talk about it being peripheral, I hadn't encountered that as a kind of legal notion before. New Zealand's peripheral to the fund, does it just mean it's beyond the sort of core of the, you know, kind of Asian economy, so it's less important to you, or what does that translate to?
Translation in actual terms, it just means that we have to invest 80% the strategy within Asia, New Zealand and Australia would fall under the 20% bucket.
Oh, okay. So not quite Asian for the purposes of the SEC rules.
That's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that may not be obvious, and I'll give you a little hint when you look at our fact sheets, is don't pay too much attention to the country allocations, because one of the ways that we actually add value is by decomposing credit currencies and interest rates so that we can actually come up with a configuration that gives you the most bang for the buck. And what I mean by that is, just to give you an example, we own, it's disclosed, Global Logistics Properties, the RMB-denominated bond of a Singaporean company. So Global Logistics Properties is just, it's a large logistics company. They own warehouses all over the world, mostly in China and Japan. Japan is a mature market, and what they do is they harvest the cash and invest it in China. And because GLP is not necessarily a household name in the RMB market, we find that we're actually able to pick up a credit spread by investing in that bond in RMB, as opposed to, let's say, in the Singaporean dollar. And so that bond itself represents the interest rate and the currency of the renminbi, but the credit exposure, if you will, of really Japan, China, as well as Singapore, because it's domiciled in that country. And so by having the ability to really peel back the onion and looking at which currency by which issuer in which capital structure might give us the most bang for the buck, we're able to find that best risk-adjusted return to put into the portfolio. So looking at the country allocation will just tell you where the domicile of that country is. And if you look at that, coupled with the currency exposure, you'll be able to get a better sense as to, you know, what the real underlying exposures would be.
Oh, okay. Great. Emily, my plan was to ask Teresa one more question and then to give folks in the audience a chance to raise theirs. If you could take a second, pal, and let them know how they would do that, they can kind of, you know, compose themselves, and then Teresa and I will go back to talking.
Sure. To ask a question, you may press star and then one on your touch-tone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, we do ask that you please pick up your handset before pressing the keys. To withdraw your question, please press star and then two. Again, it's star, then one to ask a question.
Great. Thank you. So one of the folks on the board, Andy J., had a question about the fund's expense ratio, and he has an investment in the fund. And he was kind of curious about what the future might hold. You've got two waivers in place now. He was wondering if those would continue, if 1.4% is a likely sort of neighborhood for the ER to stay in, or if there are sort of asset breakpoints, that sort of thing. But I didn't know if this is a question for Jody more than for Teresa.
Yeah, that would be a question for Jody. So a little bit on that. As you know, the fund has been around now for just over 13 months. So as fund grows in size, you always expect that your expense ratios will fall. On this fund at launch, as you noted, David, there's actually two levels of waivers. One is a voluntary level that, you know, if you read the fine print in our prospectus and our annual report, you'll note that Matthews can do away with that at any time. So I can't make any promises on what the expectation is there. But the main waiver is put in place that will continue legally through August 31, 2014. And so that is, there's another share class of the fund for those that come direct, that's going to cap that at 1.25%. The investor share, which all of you are invested in, and the one you noted at 1.4 on our fact sheet, will float above that. So long story short, for more information, you know, you'll want to look, it's literally page 111 of the annual report. Our next annual report for 2012 is going to be available at the end of February, and that's going to get into intimate detail. And just remember that the expense ratio is done over a period of time. So the fund has grown in size. We ended the year at $35 million. So as it continues to grow, that expense ratio should continue to fall.
Oh, cool. Although I'm a little intimidated at the thought of finding out the intimate details of the fund's expenses.
Well, you guys had some very detailed questions there, so I pulled out the fine print.
You're good. Emily, I didn't know if folks had queued up.
We do have one question from Jeff Wing. Please go ahead.
Oh, sure.
Hi, I have a question. Do you have any percentage band for, let's say, U.S.-denominated dollar versus non-U.S. denominated currency? And also, do you have any percentage band for sovereign debt versus corporate debt?
Yes, great question. Maybe just to give you an idea of how the portfolio has evolved, well, the short answer is no, we don't have solid bands. We have slowly but surely increased our allocation to corporates. At launch, it was just about 35% to currently it's just above 50%. So as we find more opportunities in corporate bonds, and that means as the local currency markets become more liquid, we really do hope to increase our allocation to corporate bonds. And the reason is because we really think that we have a strategic advantage compared to our peers in analyzing corporate credit. We understand and own these companies' equities. So if you have a strong opinion on their equities, you're probably going to have a very strong opinion on their debt. One of the barriers now is, as I hinted to before, is that a lot of this debt gets issued and tucked away. And given that it's a U.S. Mutual Act, 40 Act fund, We can't have more than 15% in illiquid securities. So that really constrains our ability to invest in more corporate debt. And the fact that they're local currency would even be better because that enables us to really take advantage of all three components of return. On the so I think I answered the government versus corporate. I think the other question was U.S. dollar versus local currency. Just to also give you an idea of how that has changed over time, we started the portfolio at about 32% to U.S. dollar, and now we're about 48% to U.S. dollar. So that is a substantial increase over the course of the year. And that has to do with the fact that we found more compelling opportunities within the U.S. corporate space, U.S. meaning U.S. dollar denominated corporate bonds of Asian issuers. So these are very much driven, again, from our bottom-up investment process where we find that the market might be disjointed. And so those allocations will actually change pretty substantially over time, driven by more of a bottom-up as opposed to a top-down strategic asset allocation, if you will.
Cool. Does that help, Jeff?
Can I have a follow-up?
Sure.
I just want to know how big is the Asia fixed income market, how big is the Asia equity market, and how big is the Latin America fixed income market?
Great questions. To give you an idea of the size of the Asia fixed income market, it's currently just over $5 trillion. Now, let me caveat that by saying that about half of that is in China, and the Chinese domestic bond market is relatively closed, meaning unless you have qualified foreign institution quota, you're not able to invest in it. And even if we did, I'm not sure most of those bonds actually offer relatively good value at this point. So so the actual index, as represented by the HSBC ALBI, is approximately $1.5 trillion. So that's about a third of the size of the U.S. investment grade market. So again, the overall Asia bond market is over $5 trillion, which is, you know, about between a half to a third of the U.S. Treasury market. But the index, which represents the more liquid investable universe, is about a third in size compared to the U.S. investment grade market. In terms of comparison to Latin America, Latin America has historically been a higher percentage. So if you take a look at the MB Global Diversified, Latin America was about 40% compared to Asia, which is only 19%. I haven't run the latest numbers, but I suspect that now it's slightly tilted more towards, it's increased a little bit more in Asia and decreased a little bit more in Latin America, because last year we saw quite a lot of issuance coming out of Asia. So, you know, call it 2-1 in terms of Latin America versus Asia. And then maybe, Jody, you can chime in on the equity markets, Asia equity markets. I don't think we have those numbers as we speak. But I hope, you know, putting it in the context compared to U.S. fixed income helps.
Great, it does. Em, were there other folks with questions?
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one.
And while we wait to see if folks do, I had a question indirectly from Andre, one of the readers, and it comes down to some form of why would we limit ourselves to Asia? He points out that, you know, you could do a diversified EM or a world bond fund. And you'd sort of addressed the world bond question, I think, that many world bond funds are tilted away from Asia, probably to their detriment. And you'd made a point that struck me as interesting, and I was hoping that you could help me understand it better when it came to the emerging markets. And it seemed to be this, that you're better at investing in Asia than other people are, that because you have the depth of knowledge, you can take risks that other firms can't take, and you can detect overly optimistic claims from management that other firms might not. And so I didn't know if you'd tell us, like, what does that translate to in terms of taking a risk they can't take, for example?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. You know, speaking as the former head of emerging markets at BlackRock, so the former Barclays Global Investors, we invested across all of emerging markets. And, you know, what I found was that we, despite the fact that we had a large team, you know, we were really a mile wide and not really as deep as I would like us to be. And it's really quite difficult to be spread so wide geographically and still claim to have a comparative advantage enough to actually produce relatively good performance, i.e. generate alpha relative to the market. What you end up doing is you end up focusing on the larger markets with relatively higher volatility to the detriment of having a longer-term approach that would maybe force you to look at smaller markets, which may not have the volatility for you to trade around, but actually represent really good structural growth stories. So that's part of the answer, as you had alluded to, David. And I think, David, you're absolutely right in highlighting the fact that, you know, Matthews, we're just uniquely capable of investing in Asia. In this day and age, you know, where information is not the problem, it's really the ability to distill the information into real knowledge, mm-hmm. and knowledge that's differentiated. Really need to have a high level of specialization. And given that we've been investing in Asia for 20 years, and given how the amount of work that we dedicate to very, you know, narrow questions that may not interest a world bond investor or an emerging market investor, we're able to really understand some of the risks that other might write off as being too risky. You know, maybe just to give an example, I gave a talk at the San Francisco Fed about, it's titled, The Pitfalls, Perils, and Possibilities of Investing in Asia. And I talked a lot about accounting and how you know, people are really worried about accounting in China and what are the shades of gray between sloppy accounting and fraud, and the amount of time that we spend analyzing structures like the VIE structure, which just stands for variable interest entities, of which most NASDAQ firms that are Chinese firms that are traded in NASDAQ are actually they're actually done through VIE structures. Most people don't know that, but you know, we've really taken the time to understand these VIE structures and to really understand the good VIE structures from the bad ones. And I don't think that many firms out there can actually speak to that level of knowledge and that level of dedication to understanding these key risks.
Okay. And it would be striking in the case of something like BlackRock, because the sheer size of the operation, I mean, to say, from a former director of theirs, from a former head of their EM fixed income unit, to say that you weren't comfortable with the amount of debt, depth that you had on the team, the ability to kind of cover all the markets, strikes me as kind of an important concern, since a lot of smaller folks surely would have fewer resources at hand than BlackRock.
And that's right. You know, we really, you know, we tried our best, and I think we did a nice job, but still we did not dedicate those kind of resources that I talked about in really studying the VIE structure, for example. That's very specific to China.
Okay, cool. Other questions, Em?
Yes. The next one's from Joe Naylor. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. So you teased us early on with a promise of talking about whether we're in a bond bubble, and I'd like to hear that. And if you think there's any chance that we are, why should anyone be in a bond fund or a bond-oriented fund like yours at all?
Yes. So the short answer is yes. I think the risk is tilted more to U.S. domestic bond market selling off with yields going up than it would be to yields continue to fall. It's just that the math as where we stand, where we are in the recovery cycle, and the fact that, you know, our interest rates are now really tied to our ability to recover on the unemployment front. I am of the opinion that we are making slow but steady progress in the U.S. in terms of our economic recovery. And it's really not that different from historical episodes where the crisis was really driven by a financially driven, so banking sector driven crisis. So we are very much a storybook recovery now of a very deep but a very serious crisis. And therefore, I do think that QE4 or QE5, if they come about, will not be as impactful as the first rounds of QE. And as we slowly but surely recover, there will be room for interest rates to rise. And within that environment, one could easily say, why invest in any fixed income at all? And that's where, you know, I think it's important to still look at fixed income and ask why in the first place. I think many would point to the fact that fixed income is a relatively less volatile part of your portfolio. And this particular strategy really serves that purpose. You know, it's meant to deliver the highest risk-adjusted returns of all of the strategies that we run at Matthews. And so we still think that, yes, there is a place for fixed income, but it's important to distill which asset classes within fixed income are the most sensitive to this rise in U.S. interest rates. And that's the research that I pointed to earlier, which shows that Asia fixed income is actually one of the safer places to be. So again, the beta of Asia fixed income to interest rates, U.S. Treasuries, is only 0.28 compared to about 0.7 for U.S. high yield, U.S. ag, and the global ag, as well as a 0.5 for mortgages. So I hope that answers the question.
So the short answer would be bubble, yes. And why any fixed income? You need some volatility control, and this might be the best corner of the fixed income market or one of the best corners of the fixed income market to achieve that?
You know, one of the problems with the word bubble mm-hmm. is that people imagine a bubble popping
yep.
and leading to huge disruptions. I don't see the U.S. Treasury market as a bubble in that sense. I don't see it popping as yields going up very fast and very drastically, leading to huge price depreciation. And the reason for that is because U.S. debt, as we all know, we're talking about the debt ceiling, we still have huge amounts of debt. And it behooves us to raise interest rates very slowly. And when the market sense that the level of unemployment that we're trying to reach is close at hand, the markets will probably start selling U.S. Treasuries, leading to a rise in U.S. Treasuries. However, it doesn't mean that we're going to have this sudden, punctuated bubble bursting that I think many people connotate that word. And so that's why that I don't like to use the word bond bubble, because I don't think it's going to necessarily be like a bubble of, let's say, the internet bubble of 2000. But I do think that the risks are tilted asymmetrically to yields rising and U.S. Treasuries selling off.
Cool. Other questions, Em? Emily?
Yes, the next question will come from Dean Littlepage. Please go ahead.
Hey, Dean.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to know just basically what the parameters for picking the dividend paying equities are and with the fund?
Great question. So the way we look at picking the dividend yielding equities are as follows. We look at the 10-year yield of the bond, of the local currency denominated bond, and we compare it with actually dividend yields of the stock market in those markets. Where the dividends of the market actually is higher than that of what you can get in the 10-year bond, that is a target market for us to start looking at equities. And as I mentioned, one of those markets is Taiwan. Within then that universe, what we want to do is target equities that have bond-like characteristics. And so what I mean by that is we're not going to be investing in any equity that's going to have a beta that's higher than 1 relative to the overall market. And then on top of that, we want to have stocks that dividend yielding stocks that have relatively high yield with that low vol characteristic, so that the equities typically will give us almost bond-like vol with the optionality and the upside. And in terms of how we size it, we typically start with one-third of the position. So what I mean by that is I'll start with about 75 basis points in an equity position, whereas I would start probably somewhere just under 2% with a bond position as an initial position. And so that also helps us calibrate the risk that we're taking within the dividend yielding portfolio.
Cool. Others, Emily, or are we?
Not at this time.
Great. Then we're actually fairly close to the end of our hour. And so probably I should take a moment to thank Teresa and Jody and all of you for spending your time with us tonight. I wanted to note that a tape of this call and an audio profile of the Strategic Income Fund will both be available at The Observer on February 1st. We're also delighted to note that Andrew Foster, formerly a manager for Matthews Asian Growth and Income, and now of Seafarer, is going to join us for a conference call in about 2.5 weeks. He'll be with us on February 19th. For folks who are looking for an earlier introduction to Seafarer, you might wander over to Seafarer's conference call. They're holding their call Thursday of this week. If you go to seafarerfunds.com, you'll find out how you can access those folks. And so, again, I'd like to thank you, and especially Teresa, for her generous decision to share time with us tonight. The discussion has been fairly vigorous at the Observer's discussion board. If you'd like to join there, we'd be honored by your presence, and we'll try to pass along to our readers as much of what we've learned tonight as we possibly can. So thank you all, and especially thank you, Teresa.
Thank you, David.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.